Okay, good morning, members. I'm going to call Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Members, we have a full agenda today. I may have to give the gavel over to Vice Chair Bonner to prepare for a conference committee on reinsurance. But we will try to go through the bills as efficiently as possible. So the first order of business is to take attendance. Ms. Hansen, please take the roll. The chair is present.
Good morning. Schultz, present. Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright. I don't think we have him yet. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle. I know he's here. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Present.
Representative Keel. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Noor?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Morning.
Representative Pearson?
Present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Robbins? I know she's here. Representative Sandel?
Present.
Representative Schumacher, he's also here, and I see our friend Lead Albright. We have a quorum, Madam Chair, a little sticky. I know everyone is so busy. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen, and I do understand how busy all of our members and our staff are. So, okay, the next order of business is to evaluate the minutes. So these are the minutes from March 30th. Representative Albright, would you like to move the minutes from March 30th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, any corrections to the minutes? All those members in favor of adopting the minutes for March 30th, 2022, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first bill we have on our agenda is House File 4367. Welcome to the committee, Representative Berg. Is this the first time you've been here?
It is my very first time.
Well, welcome. I'm going to make a motion to re-refer House File 4367 to the Capital Investment Committee. And I don't see any amendments. Is that correct, Representative Berg?
That is correct.
Okay, so that is my motion. Why don't you describe your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is my extreme honor to carry House File 4367 for an organization called Brittany's Place. And first, I'm going to tell you that as a flight attendant, one of the things that we are heavily trained on is to be able to identify victims of human trafficking as one of the modes of transportation that is heavily used to transport victims. This is something that is very much in my purview and that is very personal to me. So House File 4367 appropriates $150,000 in fiscal year 2023 for some upgrades to this facility. Launched in 2014 as Minnesota's first and largest emergency shelter for youth survivors of sex trafficking, today Brittany's Place offers a full spectrum of services. All services are designed to meet the specific needs of youth at risk for or who have experienced sex trafficking and exploitation. Street outreach, training services for youth serving agencies and parental counsel address prevention and intervention. Emergency shelter and a new transitional living program address housing needs. Case management services offered to clients and residents and to unsheltered clients in the community round out the care. Opening a new transitional living and a new shelter space, creating a building that has design spaces for calming emotions and making sure clients are safe. 180 Degrees has raised $400,000 privately and are asking for $150,000 to finish off the construction and capital investment. One of the things that is so very important about this bill and that this organization does so well is the desire and the ability to create a space that is trauma-informed for their victims. And I think that's really unique about this organization. So I believe I might have a testifier or at least somebody who could answer questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You do have a testifier, Representative Berg. We have with us today Dan Farr. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and introduce and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. My name is Dan Farr, P-F-A-R-R. I am the CEO of 180 Degrees. Thank you, Representative Berg. So Brittany's Place is a program of 180 Degrees, named after a young lady in St. Paul that was killed, murdered by her trafficker. Brittany's Place is a statewide asset. We are the largest shelter and space for youth in the state of Minnesota. We are doing this building project to enhance our security, to reflect a home-like atmosphere, to provide better transitional resources, including employment for our youth. We also would be the first shelter in the state to serve SEY youth that would have a trauma-informed care design, also called well design, which uses seven principles of wellness in the healing of the trauma that these girls have experienced. What I would say is that we have been successful in our private partnership, private-public partnership. We get private money for operations as well as state money, as well as county money. And so we're proud of that. And in raising this capital for the site, we have been successful in garnering $400,000 plus in cash today. And we are looking for $150,000 to finish the project. When you think of a girl that comes to us from a police raid, from the FBI, from the Dakota County Sheriff's Office at 2 a.m. and is at our doors looking for a place, a safe place to be, that's our reality. We want to make sure that our facility not only serves the girls, but serves for the safety of our staff and serves for the safety of the community as well. I thank you for considering this bill. And I want you to know that this is some of the most important work that we consider in the state of Minnesota, helping girls who have been sexually trafficked. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farr. Are there any questions from members? Representative Albright. You're muted, Representative Albright. You're still muted. There you go.
Can you hear me now?
We can.
Representative Berg, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It certainly sounds, and by every piece of the testimony that Mr. Farr provided, that this is a very worthy project. That being said, Madam Chair, it certainly sounds like this is a capital investment project that would be better served if it would were re-referred to capital investment as opposed to a grant. You're explicitly identifying a single project in the bill, which is more germane to the bonding bill, the capital investment for cash or something else rather than a grant when we only identify one person. So is it your intention to lay this over, or did I miss something that we are re-referring this to capital investment?
I think you may have missed something, but my motion is to refer it to capital investment. That was okay. My motion, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg.
Any other questions from members? Representative Pinto.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I just want to note, I've had the chance to work with Mr. Farr and actually was at the first day when Brittany's Place opened, and I remember walking through it, and it was just a terrific facility, does wonderful work. And so thank you to Mr. Farr, and thank you to Representative Berg. I'm really glad that we're moving this along. Thanks.
Any closing comments, Representative Berg?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee. One thing that I was remiss in mentioning in my opening remarks is that this is a facility that is targeted for girls between the ages of 12 and 18. So we have to remember that we're talking about children here. And
I just think that that is so important when we consider this bill, taking care of and protecting our most vulnerable. So I ask for your support in moving this bill along to capital investment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. And that's what the charge of this committee is, protecting our most vulnerable. And we try to do that every day by hearing bills that will do just that. So we appreciate your work on this, and we appreciate the testifier. So with that, members, I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 4367 as recommended to the Capital Investment Committee. And this is going to be a roll call vote, members. Chair votes aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright.
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle.
Burkle, aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Keel, excused. Representative Liebling. Liebling, excused. Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Knorr. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, aye.
Novotny, aye. Thank you. Representative Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Robbins, aye. Thank you. Representative Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. And Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Wonderful. That's 16 ayes and 3 excuses, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. So the motion prevails in House File 4367. It's on its way to capital investment. Thank you again, Representative Burke. Okay, the next bill is House File 3274. So I'm going to, my motion will be to I have to adopt the division report from the Behavioral Health Division for House File 3274. So members, this is going to be a voice vote. All those in favor of adopting the division report from Behavioral Health, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the report is adopted. My motion will be to lay over House File 3274 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. And Chair Fisher, please tell us about your bill.
I will. I'm going to leave my camera off because, as you can see, I'm having technical problems with my camera this morning. So first of all, Madam Chair, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3274. It's a response to our children's mental health crisis, specifically the lack of access to children's residential treatment program for our children. The bill itself, House File 3274, achieves the following for our licensed children residential and psychiatric residential treatment facilities, also called PRTFs. There's administration, simplification to focus staff attention on the immediate treatment of children's needs. It provides one-time funding to stabilize our children's residential treatment and PRFT levels of care with $2.5 million in emergency funding relief for our children residential continuum focused on immediate staffing needs and $2.2 million for startup and ongoing service grant for PRFT. This section includes and expands upon language in the governor's budget. As you'll hear from the testifier, due to the pandemic, we are seeing more of our children experiencing acute mental illness with symptoms that require residential level of care. And at the same moment, our ability to serve children is in collapse with the painful loss and emptying of unstaffed beds because of the lack of staff out there. And at the same time, families are desperate for care and are on 6-month waiting lists. As a result, our providers have unprecedented financial losses as they are losing revenue while also expanding our resources to recruit, retain, and train the excellent staff needed to help our children heal. This legislation will make meaningful strides to preserve our existing capacity and position providers to restore what has been lost so we can provide timely local responses to our children and families. With that, I would like to introduce my testifier, Connie Ross, Director of Residential Services at North Homes Children and Family Services.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. The first testifier we have is Connie Ross. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of this committee. My name is Connie Ross, and I'm the Director of Residential Services for North Homes Children and Family Services. We provide a community-based continuum of compassionate care to children and families serving Greater Minnesota since 1990 in Itasca, Beltrami, St. Louis, Ramsey, Washington, Cass, Aiken, and Carlton counties. We pride ourselves in a seamless continuum of care model. My testimony today is on behalf of Aspire Minnesota and our wider provider community serving children with a residential treatment level of need. Residential treatment providers strive to treat children with serious emotional disorders that have lived through horrific traumatic events such as abuse, neglect, sexual exploitation, and homelessness. Most of the children we treat are struggling with suicidal ideation, severe depression, anxiety that often results in panic attacks, aggression, fight or flight, survival mode, neurological disorders such as ADHD and fetal alcohol. We provide active treatment, including individual and family therapy, 24-hour nursing, as most of the children admit with significant medical needs, an active school day, partnering with our local school district, psychiatry for medication monitoring, and daily supportive services for daily living and positive behavior management. The complexity and volume of calls for residential treatment has significantly increased since the arrival of the pandemic. Providers are reporting 6 to 9 month wait lists, which is unacceptable for a child in need of a life-saving treatment right now. The children being referred are presenting with high mental health acuity and are at risk of serious harm in regards to their imminent safety. Suicide attempts have risen 50%. Parents, social workers, and hospitals are calling daily in despair. Without early interventions and residential treatment, we are sending our children hobbling into adulthood. Most recently, like many other residential providers across the state of Minnesota, we consolidated our residential programs due to workforce shortages to provide care to 40 children out of our 72-bed capacity, which is a significant reduction. Our operational costs continue to increase with no opportunity to increase our revenue to offset costs. Since the onset of the pandemic, our residential treatment services have lost $1.2 million in revenue. Prior to the pandemic, there were challenges accessing care for children in Minnesota due to reduced provider capacity. Frequent headlines tell of children boarding in our hospital emergency rooms and juvenile detention facilities because residential providers are full and on waiting lists. These settings are far from ideal for these children as they're not trauma-informed environments or therapeutic. Many providers have closed entire programs and or reduced capacity. As a provider, we receive countless calls from social workers, hospitals, and parents regarding the lack of access to care in our state. One of the many desperate pleas for help I recently received was from a mother in northern Minnesota. Her daughter had been a victim of sexual exploitation, was experiencing suicidal ideation, hadn't been to school in 2 years, and was at risk of being homeless. She's currently being housed in an emergency room along with 10 other children because there was not an open program to meet her needs. This mother was in complete despair at the thought of taking her daughter home prior to receiving treatment. She feared if she took her home, her daughter would eventually die by suicide. Due to workforce shortages, we were not able to accept this lady at that time. So heartbreaking for that parent to hear and for me to say. We do know that with appropriate treatment, children with mental illness can get better and do thrive. To continue to treat and give every child an opportunity for a happy, healthy life, we need your help. In order to retain our already diminished residential treatment capacity, we're requesting your support for relief funding to retain the staff we currently have, as well as to continue with our robust hiring campaigns. In addition, we have an opportunity to continue to grow our PRTF level of care, as it has proven to be very effective in treating some of our most challenged children as a result of the structured team approach supporting PRTF services. Without your support, I fear that we'll continue to lose valued residential providers. We are in a crisis that I myself have not seen in the last 30 years of work within this field. I'd like to close with this sentiment that children are our future. We all embrace this and we all know this to be true. Please model that you believe that our children are indeed valued and cared for in our state by supporting House File 3274 and helping some of our sickest children access the mental health treatment that will help them live their very best lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. Are there any questions for the author or the testifier? I'm not seeing any questions. Chair Fisher, closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Thank you, members, for the opportunity to present 3274. As we hear, there are a number of serious challenges out in the environment, and this is one of the bills that will help address the situation. I ask for the continued support and hope that will be included in the omnibus bill. Thank you much.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. So House File 3274 will be laid over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. I'm going to move the agenda a little bit because we have Representative Eklund with us now, and we're going to move to House File 4071. Representative Eklund, I just want to make sure you are here. There you are. Okay. House File 4071, I'm going to make the motion to lay over House File 4071 for possible inclusion in our Human Services Omnibus Bill. Welcome, Representative Eklund. Can you describe your bill?
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing the bill. This bill is brought to me from families who didn't have an opportunity last session to talk about what they want and need in planning future employment on the issue of the subminimum wage. Families and self-advocates who were most affected by any change related to subminimum wage were not given a seat at the planning table. Some folks in the network of families live in my district. I have a center-based 14C business in International Falls and familiar with the people there and the jobs they do in the community. They are part of our community. These families and self-advocates oppose the purpose of the task force, the elimination of their work choice in the center-based jobs programs. These families tell me about what these jobs mean to their disabled family member. They talk about how much they enjoy their jobs and how proud they are of what they do. This bill has two modifications to the task force on some minimum wage. First, it modifies the purpose. Instead of a purpose to eliminate a work choice, it calls for a plan and recommendations to promote independence and increase opportunities for people with disabilities to earn competitive wages. Task force currently has no representation of the people that choose this as their work choice. This bill gives them a seat at the table to participate in the planning. Chair Schultz and committee members, I ask for your support on this bill and these self-advocates and their families. And there are several testifiers. Chair, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Representative Eklund. The first testifier I have is Mike Datz. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Michael Datz.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Wayne Barker, and I'm the executive director of Merrick Inc., located in Badness Heights, where we offer life enrichment, minimum wage, crew, and on-site 14C work to nearly 400 adults with disabilities. One of these clients is Michael Datz, and he's with us today to share his testimony. Mike is also blind, so I'll be reading his comments. At our request, the staff in his group home talked to Mike about his work at Merrick, and the following is his response. I started working at Merrick Inc. in 1990, sanitizing headsets for Northwest Airlines. Since then, I've tried many jobs at Merrick and even worked on a crew out in the community. Eventually, I chose to move back to contract work provided by Merrick at its Fadness Heights location. I chose this because it allows me to try new tasks, afford things I need, and do activities I want to do, and socialize with my peers. I chose this because it simplifies my transportation needs to get to and from my group home. My work makes me proud. Some of the work I do is assemble COVID-19 test kits, bundle X-ray bags, and put together greeting cards. This work allows me to do activities of my choosing, such as bowling, swimming, bingo, and going out to eat with my sister. I get to make the money I need while getting to work with my friends and knowing I am in a safe environment. In my phone call to see if I wanted to work in the community, I told them I don't. This work is my choice, and I would be disappointed if I couldn't work where I want to. With that, Mike is available for any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mike Datz and John Wayne Barker for that testimony. The next testifier is James Clapper. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and then proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jim Clapper. I'm a parent of a young man with intellectual and developmental disabilities who receives MA waiver support for residential and employment services. I support HF 4071 that will redirect the current task force, which intends to eliminate subminimum wages in Minnesota. Thank you for taking my testimony. My son, Bob, has been happily employed, and he's in the background behind me here, has been happily employed since 2008 in a number of positions, all made possible under the provisions of Section 14C of the Fair Labor and Standards Act. He started his employment in a center-based employment program doing light assembly and packaging work in a day training and rehabilitation program near our home. His wages at that time were about $2.35 an hour, which were commensurate with his level of productivity. This is about 35% of what the minimum wage was at that time. Today, he works in a mobile work crew in the community at Kowalski's and earns $9.40 an hour, which is above the federal minimum wage. He has more than tripled his productivity in this time and moved from a center-based employment setting to a community-based employment setting, which we are very proud, and we are very proud of his progress. Bob is very proud of himself as well, although he does not have a firm grasp of money. The 14C provisions provided Bob with choices and opportunities to start his employment and then steadily, slowly but steadily, develop his skills and work ethic over the last 13 years. If not for the provisions of 14C, he would have had only life enrichment activities in his day training and rehabilitation program. In addition, the customers that contract this work would have moved away from disability employment programs in order to compete. On top of that, the center-based program might have been closed, which is what has happened in those states where utilization of 14C has been eliminated. Bob's story represents about 6,000 individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities who are thriving or have actually progressed through minimum wage, like my son, under the provisions of 14C, and they will lose their employment if this current task force to eliminate subminimum wages carries out their mission. I ask you to support HF 4071. The current task force is committed to only one thing, elimination of the utilization of 14C special minimum wages. This bill will redirect the recently formed task force, putting in more objectivity and adding representation from parents and guardians of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities who were specifically excluded from the original membership. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clapper. The next testifier I have is Sue Hankner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed.
Thank you. Chair Schultz and members of the committee, I'm Sue Hankner, mother of two disabled sons with multiple disabilities, ages 43 and 48. My post-secondary education is in human development, psychology of learning, and in business. I'm a retired business planner and administrator. I am president and co-founder of A-Team Minnesota. A-Team Minnesota is a network of self-advocates and families creating awareness and advocating for a full array of disability service options. We are one state among 20 states within A-Team Minnesota or A-Team Grassroots USA network. Thank you for this opportunity to present the perspective of A-Team Minnesota families and self-advocates. And we thank Representative Eklund for being the author of this bill and bringing it to you for your consideration. I submitted written testimony, and I will summarize it through 5 points. First, last June, the legislature adopted the law creating a task force to plan for the elimination of subminimum wage with an exclusive membership of organizations advocating for the elimination of Fair Labor Standards Act Section 14C subminimum wage. The legislation excluded representation of those who are most affected by elimination or any changes to 14C. Membership is deeply biased. When DHS publicly solicited membership to the task force, applicants were required to attest to a commitment to eliminate 14C as an available work option. That raises questions related to trust. We are told the task force legislation was passed to get ahead of Congress passing laws to eliminate 14C. Nothing is moving in Congress. It's stalled. We now find those anxious to eliminate 14C found a source of funds in the Department of Education, U.S. Department of Education, to redirect towards grants to states, bypassing Congress. Simply, grants are not a long-term sustainable funding source for any 14C provider. This raises more questions and concerns around trust. My second point is the purpose of the task force is clearly stated in the law to plan for the elimination of subminimum wage. I've heard some say that it's not the intent. If it's not the intent, then let's agree to modify the purpose. While the task force has no authority to change laws, it is set up as a think tank of sorts with a stated purpose, which by law is the focus of their work. Recommendations from them will be considered by future lawmakers. There is no provision for a minority report. From reading testimonies, it seems to me there is common ground. There seems to be support for a full array of work options or expansions of options. Let's begin with a purpose with that as the focus and not begin with eliminating any. 18 Minnesota opposes the elimination of 14C work options. There are no studies that support elimination. There has been no comprehensive examination of the efficacy of existing 14C certificate center-based work options, nor of any other options. There's been no examination of results in the six states that eliminated subminimum wage options. 18 families in those states are telling us that their disabled family members no longer earn a wage, and in many cases have nowhere to go during the day. Two states have passed laws that allows them to provide 14C commensurate wages no matter what the federal government does. Idaho passed legislation 2 weeks ago. Missouri law has been in place for many years. While there are those who like to reference findings of the 2020 U.S. Civil Rights Commission report, they fail to mention a couple of things. Of 9,700 written comments received by the commission, 98% were in favor of keeping 14C subminimum wage in place. The commission report doesn't acknowledge this in their findings or recommendations. The commission made only one site visit. It interviewed an insignificant number of clients, not representative of the total population in that option. Some say the commission did a complete analysis. As someone who thoroughly read the entire report and wrote a white paper on the subject, I know that's not the case. My third point is 18 Minnesota supports modifications of the subminimum wage task force as written into House File 4071. It is more inclusive in the representation of stakeholders than what passed last year. It includes self-advocates and families who are most affected. They become a participant in shaping the future, not someone on the outside looking in. The stated task force purpose in House File 4071 is to plan and make recommendations to promote independence and increase opportunities for people with disabilities to earn competitive wages. It does not begin with the elimination of any options. My fourth point is you might be asking yourself, what is 14C subminimum wage and why do these self-advocates and families want to keep it? It was established in the 1938 minimum wage laws to make sure disabled people are paid based on individual productivity. Just because someone has a disability isn't sufficient reason enough in and of itself to pay a subminimum wage. The wage for each job is individualized through a calculation using prevailing wage. It is more precise to call it a commensurate wage based on productivity. Subminimum or commensurate wage work options are an options from which a disabled person can choose. They tell us it is their choice because they want and need training and proper supports. They enjoy the social aspect of center-based work. They feel safe. It is their self-worth and it is their feeling of pride in themselves. They want this option because they didn't like others for a variety of reasons. No one is forced into a subminimum wage option. It is a choice. It is the choice of nearly 6,000 disabled Minnesotans. And my fifth and final point is eliminating 14C work options conflicts with other Minnesota laws. There's the person-centered plan law that provides for a self-definition of quality of life. We have informed choice law that provides for personal choices after being given required information and is based upon the person-centered plan. What one person chooses is not the choice of another. There are no one-size-fits-all. Eliminating 14C infringes on the civil right of a disabled person to choose their preferred work option. We are asking you to honor the work option choice of nearly 6,000 Minnesotans. A-Team Minnesota asks for your support of House File 4071. Chair Schultz, that's the end of my testimony. And when it, if it's appropriate, I'm happy to answer questions. And again, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hankner. The next testifier we have is Maren Holden from Legal Aid. Welcome, Ms. Holden. Please state your name, affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Schultz, and thank you, members. My name is Maren Holden, and I'm an attorney at Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We have really appreciated the conversations about this, and particularly your openness to conversation, Representative Eklund. But the Disability Law Center does not support changing the purpose of the task force. Paying people who have disabilities minimum wage is a civil rights issue, just like the Fair Labor Standards Act sets out minimum wages so that people who don't have disabilities don't get to choose to make less than minimum wage. We don't think that people who have disabilities should be given an option by our state to be paid less than minimum wage. People who have disabilities deserve to have chances to pursue work in their interests and strengths. And as honestly, as good as our state is on so many disability issues, we are really behind on this front. We have a relatively high number of certificate holders for 14C among the 41 states included in the October 2021 U.S. Department of Labor list of 14C certificate holders. Minnesota ranked third in of the 41 states for the number of people with disabilities being paid subminimum wages, behind only Illinois and California, which are much higher populations. Nationwide, 20% of people who have intellectual and developmental disabilities work in competitive integrated employment. Here in Minnesota, that's only 11% of people who have IDD working in competitive integrated employment. And finally, we spend about 10 times, nearly 10 times as much on facility-based work, $240 million, as we do on integrated employment, about $21 million. Changing the purpose of the task force to promoting independence does not materially differ from what we've been doing and attempting as a state for many years. We adopted an employment first policy statement back in 2014, and yet here we are, still far behind the rest of the country on this. Minnesotans with disabilities are living in poverty when they could be earning real wages, paying taxes, and accessing the independence that comes with that. We are facing a dire workforce shortage as a state, and underemployed Minnesotans who have disabilities who could fill those jobs with the right supports are not getting the support they need to do that. Many states have made this transition, and we can learn from the many providers across our state who have done this successfully. What I really want to emphasize about the task force is that taking away what currently works for people is not the goal of the task force. The task force, which started last month, is the way that we as a state figure out how to make this transition, if we chose to do that later on, in a way that preserves the important ways that people spend their time, while simply making sure that people who have disabilities get paid minimum wage. This may mean that providers need to figure out new business models, and there are grants for that included in the enacted legislation. Or we may need to take a closer look at the rates for day services, and figuring out how to do all of this is exactly the work of the task force. So let's not change the purpose of the task force now to stop them from figuring out these important solutions. I think I understand where this language is coming from. As a parent of a child who has a disability myself, and in his lifetime so far, we've had to work so hard to find the right supports for him and for ways to spend his time. I can really appreciate how hard it would feel to think that something that's been working could go away. But I also envision a future for him where he and all people who have disabilities are guaranteed the same minimum wage as everyone else. The task force is a smart use of one-time federal funds to make a plan about how we would do this. The legislature will get to make the decision later about whether to actually end the practice. I really hope the committee will continue with the purpose of the task force as enacted. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Holden, for that testimony. I'm going to hand over the gavel to Vice Chair Bonner now. I need to prepare for our conference committee on reinsurance. Vice Chair Bonner, the gavel is now yours, and we are on the next testifier, who is Alex. Is Alex Young here?
Young?
Yes.
Is it Young?
Hello, my name's Alex.
Hello.
I am part of the task force. I have a disability. My disability is autism. I am on the spectrum. I think that we should take into consideration everybody and their opinions. We know that some people we may not agree with, we may influence that some people we may agree with, but I think that we should give people with disabilities a chance to work minimum wage. I don't think we should try to put subminimum wage on people with disabilities just because they have a disability. I think that that is a cop-out. I think that is undermining the person with disabilities. And I think that we need to focus on having the disabled people speak for themselves if they can. And if they can't, well, I don't know. But I think we need to focus on ensuring that the people with disabilities have rights and that those rights are honored and respected. I personally went to another day program, the day program with Anodyne. I went there from the time I was 21 to the time I was 28. And I worked a job with some minimum wage. I mean, it was barely minimum wage. I mean, it was only $7.25 for 2 hours of work, 2 days a week. And it was really just not rewarding to me. It was not very fulfilling because it was so little pay and I had pets at the time and I couldn't feed them properly or take care of them properly. So I had to, you know, find new homes for them because this wouldn't work out. And I think that subminimum wage needs to be done away with. I think we need to put minimum wage, make sure everybody gets minimum wage, because minimum wage should be minimum wage. It shouldn't be less than minimum wage. This is wrong. This is wrong to pay people less than minimum wage. I know I sound like I'm advocating for people with disabilities to be, you know, excluded, but if they're not able to do it, then find something who can help them. You know, there are areas where you can get them the help they need. It doesn't have to be a day program. It can be a job coach. It can be someone willing to help you. It can be your family. It can be your supervisor's friend. It can be anybody. You just have to focus on your strengths, what you do. And I think that for too long, we've shut people out with disabilities because we think that it makes us feel better as people when we shut them out. And I think if we exclude people with disabilities, we're undermining our actions as good people. I mean, we need to make sure that people with disabilities have access to minimum wage. Just like everybody else, minimum wage should be minimum wage. I think there's a tree called the American chestnut that they have chapters for. It's kind of like that religion, the Jehovah's Witnesses, where they have chapters for them. I'm not saying that I'm that religion. I'm just saying there are chapters. So we should have chapters for the subminimum wage people, for the minimum wage people, where they can go, where people like you know, people that are represented from the subminimum wage group, if they lose their job, well, they can go to this chapter and get a new job. And the new job will pay them minimum wage. And then they will make more money and be able to live better lives.
Thank you, Mr. Young. We really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today and to give your testimony. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. And with that, we have our next testifier. We have Ms. Grom here from DHS. Ms. Grom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Christy Grom, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So I'll go ahead and start out maybe on a high note and perhaps a place of agreement. We don't have any insurmountable concerns about the changes in membership in this bill. So with or without those particular changes, we're already working with a communication specialist using the funds that were appropriated last session from the legislature to really make sure that we're connecting with stakeholders, even those outside of the appointed task force members. And they're helping to really guide us to understand all of those perspectives, many of which we're hearing today. Really having empathy, understanding, deeply listening, understanding kind of, you know, the fears, the anticipation, what people are excited about, and making sure that we capture all of those and document them in the report to the legislature that's due, I believe, next year. We do have a couple of operational issues with implementing the membership changes given the timeline, but we can work through those, I think, with members outside of this space. We do have some significant concerns about the changes in the purpose of the task force and the reinvention grant, so I'd like to mention a few of those for the committee. First, changing the purpose of the task force would require us to essentially redo all of our work plans or orientation materials, all of the documents, the presentations that we've been developing and that are currently being utilized for the task force. So we've already had several task force meetings. Staff have spent many hours really intentionally preparing and planning for those meetings, doing a lot of research, trying to figure out how best to structure that work. An example of some of the work that we're doing behind the scenes just this week, for example, is we've had a phone call with Oregon to learn about their experience with phasing out subminimum wages, what worked, what didn't, where we might have some blind spots in Minnesota, you know, gaps in our system that we might need to address. We have phone calls with Maryland and Ohio in the next week or so as well. So there's been an incredible amount of work that's went into this, and sort of reversing all that work would be very disappointing at best. I would say also related to the reinvention grants, we have posted RFPs for those. So we'd need to cancel any pending or executed contracts, repost an RFP, require providers to apply again, which would of course be additional cost and work for the department, but more importantly, a burden on providers who are very interested to access these funds. We know that providers want to phase out subminimum wage. They might just need a little bit of support to help transition their business model. So that's the first primary concern we have. I'd also like to note that the task force is funded using HCBS, or Home and Community-Based Services, enhanced FMAP dollars. So those are dollars that were authorized by Congress under the American Rescue Plan Act for a very specific purpose, to accelerate reforms and to innovate in the long-term services and supports policy area. So when Congress passed this provision and CMS had to go to implement it, they really recognized, like many of you on this committee, that continuing to shift our thinking related to inclusion is not just, we don't need to do that just because it's the right thing to do, or it's, you know, in the best interest of people. It's also the most practical thing to do. It's probably the necessary thing to do in light of our workforce shortage right now. So they really crafted that guidance very intentionally about, you know, making reforms that are innovative and accelerating reforms. So the changes that are in this particular bill related to the scope of the task force don't align with that purpose. They really just restate kind of status quo. We already have multiple venues that discuss and plan for, you know, how do we get more competitive employment for people with disabilities. We even have state laws codified in Medicaid statute that many of you probably recall were just passed in the past couple of years that require us to follow the state's employment first policy. So we have some concerns that the purpose and the scope changes in this bill don't align with what would be allowable under the HCBS enhanced FMAP. So we would need to probably pause our work and then have some conversations with CMS and possibly resubmit our initial state spending plans and update our quarterly spending plans to determine if we could even continue forward. And then from an overarching policy perspective, we do believe that now is the time to begin this discussion and to really work with the community to make a plan. Remember, the bill passed last year is really about making a plan. It's not about phasing out subminimum wage. That's an opportunity that the legislature might have, or you know, the federal government might have as well. But this is just planning for that possibility. Unfortunately, as others have noted, we are behind in Minnesota here, so we have a lot of planning work to do. We have one of the highest rates of reliance on subminimum wages in the nation, and we really do need to be prepared should the federal government decide to take action to phase out subminimum wage, or in case they, you know, perhaps we might have access to resources to help us phase out those subminimum wages. Speaking of planning, we've heard from some that there won't be options for people, and I really want to make clear to members that there are options for people. At the department, we have initiated day service reform several years ago to really make sure that our continuum of services does support competitive integrated employment, and then making sure that we have other ME reimbursable training programs that don't keep people kind of trapped and those training programs. And then we also have options for people who may choose not to work. So So for example, right now we have a newer service called Day Support. That's a Medicaid-funded service for people who want those meaningful activities during the day that we've heard so much about, those social connections. We also have integrated employment options that people can access while they're using Day Supports to kind of test the waters and see what works for them. So sometimes people just need a little bit of extra support with these services, and sometimes people aren't interested in employment at all or at certain times, depending on what's going on. But having options for people is something that at DHS we're very committed to, and that is exactly the purpose of this task force, to really identify what those gaps are and make recommendations if there are gaps that we need to plug ahead of any possible changes. And lastly, I'll just close by saying that at the department, we are interested in, it's really our mission to support people through our programs to meet their basic needs and to live in dignity. And that absolutely means having enough income to pay your rent, keep a roof over your head, having enough income to put food on your table for your family, to care for your pets, to pay for childcare, education, really having all those means that you need to pursue your ambitions. And our human service system should be a safety net, not something that's leaving people entangled within it. We want to have a safety net, a human service system that helps bounce people back to firmer ground where they can live full and dignified and integrated lives. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I will turn it back to you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Grom. And next on the testifiers list, we have Mr. Began.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brian Bajan. I'm a program manager with LifeWorks Services, overseeing our South Metro employment team. LifeWorks is a nonprofit providing statewide fiscal services, as well as employment and day support services to people with disabilities in the 7-county metro and Mankato areas. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today regarding LifeWorks concerns with House File 4071. LifeWorks let our 14C special wage certificate go in February 2017 because we believe people with disabilities should have the opportunity and supports to find competitive integrated employment. When our organization made this transition, 90% of the employers utilizing our 14C certificate kept people in their jobs by increasing their wages, their hours, and expanding their job responsibilities. The person served at the remaining 10% of employers were supported with finding competitive integrated employment with other companies or with transitioning to other services. In total, only 4 people impacted decided to leave LifeWorks to pursue other subminimum wage work. LifeWorks believes that eliminating subminimum wages is the right move in Minnesota and nationally. At the request of the self-advocates who supported and pushed for the bill that created the task force on subminimum wages, LifeWorks was asked to be at the table and share our experience transitioning away from subminimum wage work with the task force. LifeWorks believes in maintaining the current goal of the task force on subminimum wages. The transition away from subminimum wage work requires extensive communication and planning to ensure a smooth transition, and it will take some investment. While this was successful for LifeWorks, we would like to see other providers get assistance so their transition can be minimally disruptive to the people receiving services and the providers can keep their doors open, especially if the prohibition of 14C passes at the federal level. Providers need to be prepared. I saw in the materials submitted to this committee that Lake County DAC is making efforts in this direction. We must ensure providers like them can get the support to make it happen. That is why we urge this committee to keep the purpose of the task force as enacted. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Bajan. I appreciate that. And next we have a Ms. Nelson.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Jillian Nelson, and I am the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I am also an autistic adult, but today I'm here to speak to you about House File 4071 as the co-chair of the task force on eliminating subminimum wage. I have written many testimonies regarding this task force over the last 3 years, and my message has remained the same. This task force is about planning for the inevitable to avoid disaster for people that are currently served under Section 14C certificates, to make a plan for when subminimum wage is no longer a viable option, This is not work being done by any other group, whereas there are multiple agencies working on promoting competitive and integrated employment. We have spent far too many hearings discussing whether or not people with disabilities should be paid the same wage as people who perform at what some consider higher standards, and talking about the civil rights impact of subminimum wage. And with all due respect, at this point, these conversations do not apply to this task force's purpose. This task force does not end subminimum wage. The purpose is not to take jobs from people or close programs. In fact, it's the opposite. It is to make sure we have a plan to support these people, to employ these people, to keep these programs available. And this is a responsibility we take very seriously. I want to clarify what we're committed to. We want to work with the community to keep choices available, to keep centers and programs viable, but also to make sure that no one is paid less than minimum wage. And many programs across our state have already done this. Additionally, one of the tasks per the original legislation of this group is to gain feedback from community and stakeholders. Our job is to look at the barriers and the successes we have seen and make recommendations to ensure the people in these programs continue to have meaningful engagement and self-direction in their lives, to give guidance to programs to make the shift in business plans, to create dialogues that support families through these changes. No part of that plan centers on taking away jobs. This morning, I got off a plane from Washington, D.C. The message from the Hill to the Disability Policy Seminar was astoundingly clear. The train has left the station. We are no longer discussing if subminimum wage is eliminated. We are discussing when. This provision has been in multiple bills on Capitol Hill that have failed to be passed. But I assure you, it was not Section 14C that was the barrier to passage. It will come, whether it's in the workforce revitalization deal or an HCBS package or in the Raise the Wage Act. Our current administration has committed to this, and there is bipartisan support on the Hill. We have had 10 states in our country end subminimum wage, including California. And this current legislative session, there are 13 additional states with legislation on their floor to eliminate Section 14C in their states. And across the country, including here in Minnesota, we have seen a continuous decline in the use of Section 14C. Minnesota made a prudent and wise choice to create a plan to make sure we are prepared for the change that is inevitable. It should be recognized that all the advocacy agencies and protection organizations in the state have submitted letters supporting the work of this task force, because this is work that protects the disability community. This original legislation was brought to the legislature by self-advocates, including multiple people who had been paid subminimum wage. This group of advocates chose the task force approach over asking for simply a sunset date, because we understand the need for choices and settings. And that is what people are choosing. They are choosing the setting, not to be paid less. Choosing to be paid less than minimum wage is not a civil right. And we want programs that are serving individuals that are considered to be the most vulnerable in our state to recognize and honor equity and civil rights of people with disabilities. This task force is not here to take anything away from anyone. We are here to create a plan to prevent catastrophic losses. And that is why, as co-chair of the task force, I am asking you to support jobs and services of the people in these programs and centers. Please do not support the changes to the purpose of this task force that are outlined in House File 4071. A thank you for your time, and I am happy to answer any questions about the work we are doing on the task force.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Members, do we have any questions for the author of the bill or any of the testifiers? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I support the work that the task force is doing. I'm not a huge fan of this bill. But I will say that what's important to me as a legislator is that when the recommendations come forward to us from the task force, I want those recommendations to be successful. And one part of making sure those recommendations are successful is to make sure that everybody has a say at the task force, and all the stakeholders can provide input. And so I just really want to encourage, whether that's changing the membership, which I don't necessarily think is a bad idea, but I do want to make sure that all of the voices, the people that we've heard today, are also included in that, because I really want the recommendations, like I said, to be successful. I've looked at this issue very carefully. I've listened to all of the testifiers. We've got a number of letters in our packet. I've looked at those as well. And one thing I just want to ask a question about is from Mr. Bajan. You know, I think the information that you provided about what LifeWorks is doing is really helpful and can offer a really great model to others around the state. And can you just remind me what those statistics were you said at the beginning? I didn't quite catch everything that you said. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Bajan?
Yes, thank you for the question. So 90% of the employers that LifeWorks worked with that were utilizing our 14C certificate kept folks on the job, increased their wages to minimum wage or above, increased their hours, and also expanded their job responsibilities. It was just 10% of folks where the companies said, no, we have to end the business relationship. And then LifeWorks was able to successfully help those folks transition into competitive integrated employment with other employers.
Representative Moeller, do you have any follow-up?
Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear again. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Do we have any other members with questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a second to say thank you to our testifiers who came forward to speak up about keeping the intent of this task force in place. I see you, we hear you, you're fighting a good fight. And as a disability rights advocate, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. All right, I am seeing no other hands. Again, I will remind members, while it sounds like there's still some conversation to be had here, and I will add to the pile my own comments in that I do agree that there may be some room to consider whether or not other members should be added to the task force. I will tell you, as someone who manages teams for a living, the one thing that I am sometimes hearing in this bill and echoed through a few folks is that it feels that conversation with stakeholders and folks in the community who are directly impacted, you know, the old expression, nothing about us without us. And it feels like there's maybe some of that feedback loop that needs some improvement. But certainly appreciate the work of the task force and all that they are doing. With that, members, the intent of this bill today is to, in fact, lay this over for possible inclusion. And hopefully we can continue to have some conversations in the interim about that. And with that, we will lay that the bill over. I need to go back in my notes here. 4071.
Yep.
There we go. All right. And next, it looks like we do have Chair Schultz back in order to work on the next bill on the agenda for today, which is House File 4307. And Representative Schultz, it looks there like there is an author's amendment, the A22. Would you like to describe it and move to amend it?
Yes. Bill? The A22 amendment to House File 4307 does three things. It, one, incorporates new proposals that were released as part of the governor's post-February forecast budget revisions, and DHS will present this in a moment. Second, it updates funding levels to reflect forecast updates and revisions to existing proposals in the revised budget. And third, it incorporates technical fixes identified by DHS following the release of the governor's initial budget. So I'd like to move to amend House File 4307 with the A22 amendment.
Are there any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, we'll do a simple voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? All right. And the bill is amended. And with that, Chair Schultz, if you'd like to speak to your House File 4307 as amended.
Well, this is the governor's supplemental budget, so I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Harpstead, and I want to thank her for being with us today.
All right. Commissioner Harpstead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Chair Schultz, Rep Bonner, and members of the committee.
All right. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Waiting for a set of slides to come up.
There we go.
So very pleased today to be able to present to you some of the incremental changes in the governor's revised supplemental budget. The approach to the revised budget especially focused on tackling the workforce shortage through multiple strategies, building on previous investments and leveraging federal dollars. And then overall to provide investment, prioritize investment to ensure people have access to the services and supports they need. Next slide. This is how our revised supplemental budget package breaks down in terms of the various accounts, funds that run through the DHS budget. I'll leave it here for just a moment for you to see how this flows through the various accounts. Next, I'd like to talk about the maintenance of coverage in our public health care programs. This is as much in the jurisdiction of Chair Liebling's committee, but I want everyone to know what we're up to here this year. In March of 2020, DHS stopped most annual eligibility renewals and eligibility checks and adverse actions on enrollment for Medicaid and all of and Minnesota Care and our public health care programs as a federal requirement and a condition of enhanced federal funding through the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Next slide. And one of these days, as the federal emergency ends, the Department of Human Services will have to oversee the resumption and completion of renewals within 12 months for every one of the 1.4 million Minnesotans who are now in our public health care programs. So this proposal phases in a return to normal, provides some project management resources to be sure we get this absolutely right and no one falls through the cracks, and to support navigator organizations in the counties and the tribes who will do the actual recertification. It gives enrollees time to spend down assets and extends forgiveness of unpaid MAEPD premiums, ensuring continued access to healthcare coverage for people with disabilities. It provides resources for electronic income verification and capacity to conduct disability determinations and seeks to ensure continued access to critical services, including supports for older adults, people with disabilities, treatment and recovery support for people with behavioral health needs. It's a massive project coming to us. Our counties, tribes, and navigator organizations will have to do the on-the-ground work. Every state in the nation will be doing the same thing. And we really want to be sure that we get this right. And so we've worked here to add a few changes to the process and, again, to add some additional project management resources to DHS so we can absolutely nail this one and not have people fall through the cracks. Next slide. The other major part of the supplemental revised budget that we want you to see is the workforce revitalization package. We had one in the governor's original supplemental budget. We now have multiple strategies to revitalize the direct support workforce and services for people with disabilities, older adults, housing, and behavioral health. $167 million in the first biennium and $102 million in the second, with ongoing impacts in many investments, and over $121 million in additional federal funding, which gets leveraged as a result, a total of $390 million investment. It includes a workforce incentive fund, which you've heard from us before. It now includes behavioral health workforce investments, a rate increase for PCAs and the CFSS supports, and additional operational strategies. And I'd like to have you turn it over now to Elise Bailey, our budget director, for more additional detail.
Apologize. And with that, Ms. Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the commissioner mentioned, for the record, I'm Elise Bailey, Budget Director for the Department of Human Services, and I will quickly go over some of the more finite details of the workforce package in the governor's budget, and then a few of our other proposals in the budget. So as the commissioner mentioned, we have a workforce incentive fund within the budget. and it's a total of $138 million. Our original proposal had $115 million towards this use. And so in this updated budget, we've added additional funds, specifically $20 million for mental health providers in addition to what we had already proposed earlier. Some specific details about this fund. So providers will be able to apply for funds within this workforce grant fund to provide incentives to their employees, and those incentives can be whatever the provider identifies that will work for them to be able to retain and maintain their staffing. And that can include retention incentive and bonus payments, loan or tuition reimbursement, or child care and transportation costs for their workers. Workers have to make $30 an hour or less, and there's a maximum amount that each worker can get. We're estimating that this workforce incentive fund could cover benefits between 28,000 and 250,000 workers who serve over 340,000 people across the state. So a big group of very important workers, and making sure that the people receiving services in this space have access to them. We also have pretty significant investments in our behavioral health workforce in addition to that workforce incentive fund. So in this revised budget, we're providing $1 million per year in peer training to expand the peer workforce, adding $5 million to the current cultural and ethnic infrastructure grant, and then also creating a new ongoing behavioral health provider workforce grant that serves rural and underserved communities. And these grant funds will reimburse providers for costs such as the cost for supervision of interns and clinical trainees, and to reimburse staff for the cost of their master's degree tuition and licensing and exam fees. So really trying to retain and increase the amount of workers we have in the behavioral health space. In this updated budget, we also have ongoing rate increases for our personal care assistance and community first services and supports programs. So these are really important services that provide foundational services to people living in their own home with their day-to-day activities, such as bathing, eating, dressing, and other activities of daily living. You might remember you all passed a really important rate framework into law last year. But that was only implemented at about 75% of what we had determined would be the cost to provide the services in comparison with how other rates are paid. So this proposal would move that up and provide a 5.4% rate increase for these services. We're estimating that this will be about $214 million over the budget horizon, $93 million of that in state costs. And this will impact a large amount of people. 45,000 people receive services across the state, and over 40,000 workers work in this field. We also have some administrative solutions to try to help with this workforce shortage. So we have $510 million in 2022-23 and $1.6 million in the next biennium to give us resources to enable us to update and develop new web content, resources, and materials that could support matching recruitment and retention efforts. Right now, we have the Direct Support Connect app that enables people to connect with workers looking for work, and this would enable us to translate that into different languages and provide a more robust content for people looking for supports. Next slide. And then we're proposing to expand the culture of safety initiative. We also have this in our policy bill, but in this proposal, it's really giving the resources to enable us to expand this pilot statewide. So this is about $660,000 in this biennium and 1.5 in the next. And it would enable us to take this pilot and put it statewide, provide reimbursement to lead agencies and providers to participate in the systematic incident reviews. And why we have this in the workforce package is that data shows that safety science improves workforce retention as it really kind of changes the cultural aspects of the workplace. And then just quickly, there's a few other proposals that we have in this revised budget. You'll see an increased investment for Emergency Services Program, or ESP. Our original budget had about $35 million in the first biennium, and in this proposal, we've added $20 million to really target local and tribal governments and nonprofits to help them avoid losing current bed capacity that was funded through federal pandemic aid. We also have the Opioid Treatment Program Rate Integrity Proposal. So this is a federal compliance as well as addressing concerns noted by the legislative auditor. This proposal would unbundle the current rate structure and would separate the payment for drugs from the payment for services provided to a person. We also have the HCBS FMAP Spending Plan Technical Changes Proposal in this revised budget. As we've presented in the past to this committee, we have the $680 million HCBS FMAP spending plan that was approved through the federal government in January. That came out of the bill last year with over 50 different initiatives for improvements to the HCBS system. However, it took longer than expected to get federal approval of that plan, and many of the items, the implementation of those items had been delayed. So what this proposal does, it's a budget-neutral proposal that enables us to spend 2022 money that was appropriated throughout the year of 2023. You might remember in our initial budget that we had a proposal that would refinance TANF funds to pay for the Working Family Tax Credit. You'll see in this revised budget that that proposal has been removed. And then lastly, we have some collective bargaining obligations. It includes funding to incorporate some memorandums of understanding between SEIU Healthcare and the state of Minnesota. It's about $8.7 million in the budget. And with that, that was a very quick run through, but happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey and Commissioner Harpstead. And with that, we do have six testifiers. I do want to make sure that we have time for members to ask questions. So I will want to remind all of our testifiers to try and keep it tight on this and confine your comments to about 2 minutes. And I do want to remind members that the intent is to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Just to make sure that is clearly stated. And with that, Mr. Hamilton.
Good morning, Chair Schultz, Rep. Bonner, and members of the committee. My name is Ryan Hamilton, Government Relations Associate for the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I come before you to express our support for Article 4, Section 4 of House File 4307, which would make eligibility for Minnesota care available to undocumented citizens, children under the age of 19. Minnesota's Catholic bishops have consistently supported principled health care reform derived from our core values, which are respect for the dignity of every human life, concern for the poor and vulnerable, and advancing the common good. Like any basic element of life, health care is necessary for development, it sustains us, and it should be accessible and affordable to everyone. Unfortunately, undocumented immigrants in Minnesota find themselves marginalized from a system that should protect and heal them. Our interest in this issue stems from our belief that healthcare policy should strive to make healthcare available and accessible to everyone, especially the poor and vulnerable, regardless of immigration status. We also believe expanding Minnesota care access makes sense as a matter of prudent stewardship of our fiscal resources. Under current law, undocumented immigrants are only able to receive the care in the most expensive setting, and that's the hospital emergency room. The eligibility expansion proposed in House File 4307 would allow immigrant children to receive care in a less costly primary care setting, which would reduce uncompensated care for our hospitals in the long term. We appreciate Rep. Schultz's foresight and willingness to include a healthcare option for undocumented children in her bill. And as always, we are grateful for all of your work on behalf of all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. And next up, we have Ms. McGregor. Ms. McGregor?
Yes.
All right, there we are.
There we are. Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and members. My name is Ann McGregor, and I work for Minnesota Valley Action Council. It's based in Mankato. We are the community action agency that serves the nine counties in South Central Minnesota, and it has a goal of building community resiliency and moving people from out of poverty. And I'm very excited here to be with you today to share one success story that shows the impact from the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program, known as FAME, which is expanded in House File 4307. I've been in the FAME program since its beginning, and back in 2004, Erica came to Minnesota Valley Action Council asking about using the FAME program for the first-time homebuyer goal. At that time, she didn't qualify for FAME because she didn't have earned income to put into the savings. She left disappointed, but she was determined. And a few months later, she contacted Minnesota Valley Action Council saying that she found a job. And so we were able to open her account in February of 2005. In August of that year, she completed the 12-hour of Four Cornerstones Financial Literacy course that is required as part of the FAME program. And through that, she realized she needed to get a better paying job. And we discussed strategies for her in how she could purchase her first time home by increasing her income or decreasing her debt. So getting the better paying job was the first step of increasing her income. Erica found a more affordable living arrangements through her church, and she kept working now as a CNA. And then all of a sudden, her deposits stopped. And I was getting a little concerned. And with the program, you send them their statements each month, and it was kind of like, is there something going on? Do I need to help you with anything? And then in February of 2006, the front desk called me to say that Erica was in her office and she was looking for me, and she was really excited. She says, I have some wonderful news. I'm going to be closing on my home. And here's a check to finish out my FAME savings. And I was stunned, and I looked at her. I go, but what happened here? And she said, well, remember back when we talked about the different types of savings accounts? I took my tax refund and I put it into a CD so that it would get more interest and I'd have more money. So she deposited her money and was able to purchase her home through the City of Mankato's first-time homebuyer program. It was subsidized, but she was still required to put down at least $1,500. And due to FAME, she had $3,800 to put down on her house and was able to move in. Erica told me her main motivator for all of this was her three-year-old daughter, Grace, to see mom get up and go to work. See, Erica was the third generation in her family to be on welfare and live in poverty, and she wanted to break that cycle for her daughter. Just last month, Erica came to MVAC or contacted us to let us know she wanted to use one of our other programs, the only program she's now eligible for any longer, and that is Minnesota Housing's first time or fix-up program to fix up her home that she had purchased that many years ago. And she's now a manager of a nursing home. And so she has broken that cycle. And Erica is just one of the success stories from FAME that I personally have seen firsthand on how FAME helps people build wealth and move out of poverty. But we currently do not have enough funding to meet the needs across the state. HF 4307 increases funding for FAME to $5 million annually, helping us reach 10 times more people and creating so many more success stories like Erica's. With this funding, so many more people will be able to move out of poverty. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Mr. Sawada.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Brian Sawada, and I'm the Regional Director for Behavioral Health Group. Behavioral Health Group is the largest outpatient opioid treatment center in Minnesota, with approximately 3,000 Minnesotans currently under our care. We are also the largest network of Joint Commission accredited outpatient opioid treatment and recovery centers in America, with 116 locations in 23 states and Washington, D.C. We are opposed to the governor's proposal that changes the rate reimbursement system for opioid treatment programs. DHS claims that the proposal is budget neutral, but based on our analysis, the proposed rate system would result in over a 30% rate cut for the average medical assistance methadone fee-for-service patient we serve. This cut would have a significant impact on our ability to continue to provide treatment to Minnesotans. The proposal is based on flawed assumptions. For example, DHS analysis assumes that the average length of treatment is 160 days. This is at odds with federal guidance and best treatment practices and is inconsistent with our patient experience. When basing a new system on averages, there will be winners and losers. With the crisis we are already facing with opioid deaths, can we afford moving forward with a new system that hasn't been fully vetted? Behavioral Health Group is not opposed to sensible rate reform. Various models used by other states and Medicare achieve DHS stated goals of transparency and accountability without destroying the structure of supports for those dealing with opioid substance disorder. There are better solutions, and we are committed to finding them along with a broad group of stakeholders. Thank you for your consideration and your commitment to addressing the opioid crisis that we are facing as a state and a society.
Thank you for that. And next we have up Ms. Silverness.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tina Silverness, and I am the CEO for the Center for Alcohol and Drug Treatment here in Duluth. I am also on March's Board of Governors and the co-chair of Government Affairs Committee. Today, I am testifying on behalf of March and the Center for Alcohol and Drug Treatment. The OTP rate structure that is being proposed by the department will have unintended consequences throughout the state. It will not accomplish the goals of improving patient access or improving quality of care. In fact, it may have the opposite impact. Most providers will have one of two choices if this rate structure is adopted: close their doors or move to a payment model that does not accept state-funded patients. There are only 16 OTP clinics throughout the entire state of Minnesota. And the MAT services or OBOT programs that DHS referred to, which is very different than an OTP, have also struggled. This is in large part due to the continued stigma in the medical field, and they are financially difficult to sustain. These MAT programs have many unbillable services, and they need adequate medical and clinical staff to be effective. There's been very little to no dialogue between the department and providers throughout this process, which, by the way, started in the summer of 2022, or the summer of 2020. In January of 2022, treatment directors were invited to a presentation and told at the end of the presentation what the OTP rates would be. And those providers who were present did voice their objections. Later, when the providers were allowed to submit written feedback in the public comments, which they did, there was no response. We did not have a voice in this process and this proposal. Our ClearPath clinic in Duluth serves 550 patients. We also have an MAT clinic. This is because the first 4 years Our OTP clinic was open, we attempted to serve both methadone and buprenorphine patients in one clinic. There were many issues with this model, and it did not work. Both populations received better care in separate settings. CDT is a small, nonprofit community-based agency that is barely covering its costs now with the current rates. And there are no other OTPs in Duluth. Patients would have to commute 2 to 3 hours just one way, which would be a total of 4 to 6 hours every day, round trip, just to get their medications if our clinic closes. With the serious workforce shortages and Minnesota's treatment access continuing to decline as overdose death rates increase, this is not the time to limit access due to OTP closures. Methadone is an evidence-based life-saving medication that works. We do want to work through any and all concerns that DHS may have with OTPs, and we do appreciate the department's reasoning and intention behind this bill, but we do not see this proposed rate structure as a solution. An alternative option would be if DHS would consider switching to a Medicare billing model versus this proposed rate structure, This could be a win-win for both department and providers. So thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify. And this concludes my testimony, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Silverness. Next up, we have Mr. Jadwin.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Jadwin. I'm the mental health professional manager at Hennepin Healthcare. I oversee our intensive outpatient mental health programs, including adult day treatment, partial hospitalization, and our mother-baby program. In the governor's budget, we are supportive of many items, as noted in the letter of support. Today, I'm focusing on mental health adult day treatment, the rate increase on lines 97.21 through 97.25. Adult day treatment programming allows for 3 hours of services per day with a maximum of 15 hours per week, and the overall length of treatment is usually between 2 to 4 months. This level of mental health care is intended as a step-down transition for more intensive treatments like inpatient hospitalization, but is also an effective intervention to prevent these more costly and life-interrupting treatment options. Day treatment services consist of various therapies, skill building, and one-to-one individual support. More details are included in the handout in your packet. We help our patients recover from their mental illness and rediscover how and why they have a life worth living. This includes skills to thrive independently, like learning how to navigate public transportation, improving their relationships, and building healthier coping strategies. There are three challenges that make this rate increase so necessary. First being that the rates have not changed since 2004. That's 18 years. And the current payment structure does not come close to covering the cost of offering these intensive services. The second is designed as group treatment processes. Adult day treatment, COVID has made these in-person meetings difficult, to say the least. The transitions to virtual care led to lower enrollment and inconsistent engagement. Our physical space isn't able to accommodate the same number of people while allowing room for social distancing. And we're also experiencing staffing challenges like many others in healthcare. Finally, the lack of parity is glaring and is an issue of health equity. Adult day treatment is paid for by Medicaid, but few commercial insurers cover the service, and therefore fewer providers are offering it. A similar service, referred to as IOPs or intensive outpatient programs, is not covered by Medicaid. This leaves adult day treatment as the only option for this type of service for recipients of Medicaid. Without it, there is a massive gap in the continuum of mental health care. In closing, payment rates, COVID, and parity combined have made our capacity to continue offering these services to be incredibly difficult. Even a 50% rate increase keeps the cost relatively low overall at $261,000 for the remainder of this biennium and $1.35 million for the next biennium. We are deeply appreciative of the governor and DHS staff for including this as a priority, and we thank you, Representative Schultz, for carrying this bill.
You're muted.
I'm muted.
Mr. Bonner.
Apologies. Our last up, we have, Jin Lee Phelan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jin Lee Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, or MACMEP. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for this opportunity to testify on House File 4307. MACMEP represents 34 community mental health programs and agencies across the state, serving all who come for services regardless of where they live, insurance status, or their ability to pay. This includes over 200,000 individuals, families, and children who are on public programs. We are grateful for the significant investments that House File 4307 and the A22 amendment make into our mental health system, particularly during this period of such heightened needs for more access to care. This includes the over $118 million in workforce support funding, and specifically the $20 million for mental health workforce grants, the cultural and ethnic infrastructure grant increases, grants for mental health supervision, $5 million in rural mental health grants, peer training funding, funding for projects for the transition from homelessness, housing supports for behavioral health, expanded uses and eligibility for the Behavioral Health Fund, children's mobile health crisis expansion funding, the adult day treatment rate increase, inpatient and PRTF funding increases, as well as the ongoing supports for children, adult mental health grants, and SUD treatment and prevention grants. Specifically to the workforce funding, we are very grateful for the immediate support to sustain our workforce and mental health. We look forward to continued partnership with the administration to ensure sustainability of our direct services and programs. Given the critical issue of need that this is, and the multiple proposals coming forward during this session, We look forward to partnering with the department and this committee in pulling together some of the best ideas across proposals and putting our heads together collectively to address the issue this session. Thank you also for funding the first episode psychosis programs and the emerging mood disorder grant programs, and recognizing how vital it is that we have early detection and treatment. We're also hopeful that we can partner with the state to look at additional mechanisms for ongoing support of services in public education, engagement, and awareness outreach work, as such outreach and community engagement is so necessary and important for building the relationships to connect individuals to care. Regarding the children's mental health community of practice, we look forward to learning more about this and assisting to make the work and recommendations of this community of practice sustainable. And to the Article 4 healthcare access pieces, we appreciate and support the continuous 12-month eligibility in medical assistance for youth under the age of 21 and the citizenship exceptions for children under the age of 19 for Minnesota care eligibility. MACMEP and our member mental health programs greatly thank the administration and this committee for the investments into our mental health system. We look forward to continued partnerships to sustaining access to these critically needed services during this time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Phelan. With that, do we have any questions for Chair Schultz or the testifiers? Representative Albright.
Not a question per se, Madam Chair, but just a comment that these are some fairly broad reaching, fairly expansive recommendations and proposals from the governor. And I would look forward to further consideration of them in consult with our members, as well as with Chair Schultz and her members, as well as we move forward towards conference committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Seeing no other hands, Representative Schultz, would you like to close?
Well, I just want to thank everyone for their testimony today, and I want to thank the department. I know how hard they're working, and our members. I look forward to working with you as we put together our omnibus bill.
All right. And with that, I will lay over House File 4307 as amended to be included in the House or the Human Services Finance and Policy Bill. And with that, members, that brings us to the last item on our agenda today, also Representative Schultz. And I will make the motion to lay over House File 4447 for possible inclusion in the Human Services Omnibus Bill. I will remind members this bill may sound a little bit familiar because we have heard it previously. So with that, we want to have a chance to re-review this. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, members. And we ran out of time last time. That's why I'm bringing this bill back. And I know there's a lot of wonderful things in what I'm calling our workforce bill. I just want to quickly highlight some and then take testifiers that weren't able to testify last time. But in this comprehensive workforce package in House File 4447, there's an elderly waiver framework increase, which is very, very important. It allows providers to increase staff wages and compete for direct support workers. There's also a odd-numbered year inflation index using the Bureau of Labor Statistics data. There is money in there to increase wages for personal care assistants. The bill provides up to a 10.2% increase, which I know we continue need to do with the shortage. There is an increase to our homemaker services reimbursement rates, which I've received a lot of emails about. And then there's something called the Workforce Incentive Funds, and these are grants that can help disability, behavioral health, housing, and older adult service providers of public programs to pay for incentive benefits to current and new workers. We're expected to put $50 million in there for fiscal year 2023 and $60 million in subsequent years. And the allowable uses are retention and incentive payments, loan or tuition reimbursements, payment for childcare costs, transportation costs, other costs associated with retaining and recruiting workers. This is very important incentive funds. There's behavioral health workforce training and development for peer training and funding to provide training and development for mental health certified peer specialists, mental health certified family peer specialists, recovery peer specialists, and the request is for $1 million annually starting next year. There's a new program that many states are excited to see that Minnesota is doing this, and we are acting as a role model, but there's mid-skilled healthcare job demonstration project. The bill invests $19.5 million into a four-year demonstration project that integrates workforce and support services with post-secondary education to increase the number of people earning at least a two-year degree in healthcare occupations. This will support partnerships between post-secondary institutions, adult basic education providers, and community-based agencies to provide and support structure of housing, income support, childcare, and wraparound services to address barriers that prevent people from completing degrees. There's workforce supports on campus and invests money. I think it's $139,023, $2.6 million in 24, and $3.4 million each year thereafter to support workforce services on Minnesota state campuses to increase the number of students completing degrees and finding work in their fields. This is a collaboration between DHS, the Office of Higher Education, and Minnesota State. And this idea builds on the SNAP employment and training program. And then there's other initiatives in the bill that we heard about last time, but I want to go right to testifiers before we run out of time. Thank you, Chair Bonner.
All right. With that, first up, I have Mr. Wolfer. Mr. Wolfer, are you available?
Yes, ma'am, I am. Chair Schultz and members of the committee, my name is Joseph Wolfer. I'm a PCA caregiver. I live in Fairmont. I'm testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. We represent over 50,000 healthcare workers, including over 20,000 self-directed home care workers. We support House File 4447, which includes a significant rate increase for PCAs. This is my third year as a PCA for my client. I'm a driver. I schedule appointments. I'm a physical therapist. I lift my client because she cannot stand. I cook, I clean, I do laundry, I bathe and dress my client. I provide emotional and physical support. I deliver a sense of pride, respect, and independence with compassion that every person deserves. I try to provide the kind of care that you would want for your own loved ones. Despite this essential work, I struggle to provide for my family on what I make as a PCA each pay period. I must decide what bills to pay. I try to make sure there is food in my house so my family can eat, but I am still not sure what next month will bring. I have no savings. I live check to check. I will not be able to retire. I am not looking to get rich, but I deserve a sense of security for myself and my family. I make $14.40 an hour simply because I got a raise last year, because you funded and ratified our most recent contract. Since I got a raise last July, it seems the cost of everything else has gone up more. I've noticed many jobs posted that offer more than I make as a PCA. Every time I see that or see a job that pays more, I'm torn by my desire to do more for my family. But as a caregiver serving as a PCA for my client, this is part of who I am. I'm sorry. So many caregivers hold on to these jobs until we lose everything and we can't fight anymore. The extra funding in this bill would help people like me get fairer wages and a bonus that would be a big help. Whether there is a rate increase for our home care programs, whether there's a rate increase for our home care programs, it is very important that workers can negotiate a contract. A contract makes sure the money goes to the workers. We are still clarifying some details about how this will work with the Department of Human Services, but we understand that this money would be bargained over and as part of a contract. PCAs and the clients we serve face a workforce crisis because this work has been invisible for far too long. My own agency just lost 6 workers over the last pay period. To fix the problem, we need big pay raises for workers. Only this will attract and keep tens of thousands of workers we need. So, we need more money from the state and a strong voice for the workers. We thank the author for this major investment and look forward to making sure it guarantees the voice of our workers. If there are any questions, I can do my best to answer them. If not, I can defer them to other SEIU leaders and things of that nature.
Thank you, Mr. Palin, or Mr. Rolfer, excuse me. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. I know how hard our PCAs work one-on-one with their clients and how much their clients truly appreciate the services that you provide and how they really couldn't do it without you. So thank you so much for your work.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. We love doing it. This is why we stick in here. Like I said, we push and push and push. We just want to be treated fairly. You know, I'd like to not be able to walk down the street and see that I can make more at McDonald's or a gas station. Not that I'm discounting that work. That is still work. But I take care of human lives. I'm responsible to make sure my client feels independent and has the confidence to go through her day. And I think compensation is fair.
So. As my grandmother used to say, it's the Lord's work. So thank you so much with that, Mr. Rolfer. And with that, we do have one last testifier on the agenda for today. Ms. Palin, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm Ginny Palin with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and I'll be very quick. Thank you so much for this opportunity to testify on House File 4447. We are very grateful, again, for the significant investments that this bill also makes into our mental health system at this critical time. Specifically, thank you for funding the workforce incentive grants for the mental health supervision grant funds, the on-site workforce support services at post-secondary institutions, the significant annual investment into peer training for our workforce, and the workforce support funding. Thank you very much, Chair Schultz and committee members, for these investments. We look forward to continued partnerships with you in sustaining these much-needed services and access to this care. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Palin. And with that, members, I will let you know that Chair Schultz unfortunately had to step away for a moment because of a conference committee. But we do have the testifiers here still at the moment. Representative Robbins, did you have a question for one of the testifiers?
Perhaps. I was going to ask Chair Schultz, but maybe someone else can take it, so I'll just throw it out there and see if anyone wants to respond. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I had a call from a constituent today whose son lives in a for-profit home that, according to line 5.1 of the bill, will not be eligible for these workforce grants. And they get the same funding. The for-profits actually pay taxes on their steps. So I'm just wondering, why were for-profit homes not included in this?
All right. Do we have someone that can field that question? Do we still have someone on from DHS or the commissioner?
Well, Madam Chair, I can follow up with Representative Schultz separately. Thank you.
Apologies, Ms. Representative Robbins. She's trying to do multiple tasks at once here.
So. Yep, totally get it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Ms. Fang, if you could make a note, of course, that we should follow up with Chair Schultz on that as well. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine, I think, may be answered directly by DHS. This is regards to the phase-in rate changes. I know Chair Schultz addressed the need for the elderly waiver. What are we doing with the disability waiver customized living rates? Are we planning to also increase the rates for them? I didn't see it in the governor's recommendation. What's the plan for that section?
All right. Do we still have Ms. Grom in our list? Trying to check and see if I see her here. Or do we have someone from DHS that can speak to that?
Hi, Madam Chair.
Hello. Welcome back, Ms. Grom.
Thank you. Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. So, Madam Chair and Representative Noor, we don't There isn't an increase for customized living in this particular bill.
Okay. Representative Noor.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's also a need to look into areas where there's a need to provide additional resources because of the challenges many folks are facing because of the workforce shortages. We understand there's several discussions that are going on. My intent is to see that we have a fair and balanced process when we're doing rate setting phase in for the services that we provide, but also noting that there's also a need to look into the entire 245D, which I will have more conversation later on as we contemplate on how we proceed. So thank you so much, Madam Chair. I appreciate that.
Thank you for the good question. Representative Sandel, you had your hand up. I just want to make sure we don't miss you if you had a question.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I had the same question as Representative Robbins, and wonder if anyone from Human Services might have a response to that question.
Okay. Ms. Graw?
Madam Chair, Representative, I really cannot speak on behalf of Representative Schultz and her intent with this bill. I think targeting grant funding to nonprofits may have been, an intention to make sure that with limited funds that we're targeting those to providers who are really focused on not making a profit and really need them the most. But I would really have to defer to the bill author on that question.
All right. Well, it sounds like we may have a follow-up question for Chair Schultz to get some clarification. I will remind folks that the intent of the bill today is to lay this over for possible inclusion. So that does give us a little bit of time to reconnect with Chair Schultz on that particular question. And with that, members, I am going to lay over House File 4447 for possible inclusion in the Human Services Omnibus Bill. And our next meeting of members is, looks like we may have, Wednesday. All right. Keep an eye out for some additional notices that we may have. I know we do have a placeholder for Friday, but certainly we'll send out more information on that for you as we get more available. All right. With that, members, yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that note, the CA for the committee just sent out probably about an hour ago a cancellation for the meeting that was tentatively scheduled for tomorrow.
Sorry, my agenda was not quite up to date at the moment, but yes, it does look like we will not be using the hearing tomorrow, which means that we will probably be re-adjourning or commencing next week. With that, members, I will adjourn the meeting for today, this session of the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Division.